Hey, this is Mikey again, and this is the second podcast episode. I'm recording with this podcast experiment, but it's the third episode to actually go up online. I'm just putting it as part of the UFCUTAS.org podcast at the moment, because I don't know how long this thing will go on for. But it's kind of evolved in that short period of time into a bit of a kind of podcast pen pal relationship thing, because I posted up an episode thinking about church and live stream and online and all that kind of stuff, and then Rory Shiner over in Perth recorded a little bit of a response after I listened to it, and I posted that as episode two with his permission, and I thought, well, that's kind of fun, and maybe that's what this can be, that it can be a little bit of a conversation back and forth between Rory and I. So, hey Rory, how you going? It's Mikey again down in Hobart, and a bit of context. I've just been drinking my Twinings Australian afternoon tea, which is a bit of a favourite here at the moment. It's quite a strong kind of billy tea sort of flavour, but milky and sugary as tea should be. Otherwise, it just tastes like tea. I'm sitting in the front room because our family, as every family is, I suppose, we're kind of hot desking around the house, and my son's got the study at the moment, and kids are in another room, so I'm in like our kind of TV room. At the moment, it's a fairly cold, dreary day here in Hobart, about 10 degrees or something gross. And as we bounced around ideas, I think, on text message, I thought it'd be interesting to think a little bit about hamartiology, the doctrine of sin, and particularly how it then relates to the experience of temptation and desire. It's a theme that's kind of come to my attention and I've sort of seen but not engaged deeply with over the last few years as it's been brought up, especially by explorations of what it means to be a same-sex attracted Christian or a gay Christian or an ex-gay Christian. All that kind of discussion has come into then how do we think about sin and identity and desire and temptation, all that kind of stuff. And it was something I realised I hadn't really thought in too deeply about, and when I began to think into it and to read into it, realised that, hey, you know what, there are areas of hamartiology, of sin, that I haven't been taught too deeply about, and I haven't read in too deeply about, and I don't think it's just me. I think in our circle, I'm keen to see if you agree, but I think in our circles there are certain simplicities around a bunch of systematic theology areas. You know, you could say kind of doctrine of the sacraments is another, and the details of Trinitarian theology and Christology is another. There's these systematic categories don't get handled super well by a biblical theological method on its own. And so you and I have kind of come up in an era of evangelical Christianity and in circles where biblical theology has been at the forefront. These things have kind of been underdone. So it was in understanding particularly the doctrine of sin and concupiscence, evil desire, sinful desire, and what the Roman Catholic view of that was, as opposed to what the Protestant Reformation view of that was, that really kind of got me thinking in a new way about new things. I'd done some thinking about original sin and original guilt before, and I thought I'd had a pretty good understanding of total depravity, but then this kind of comes at a new kind of angle again, and so here we are. I don't want to focus this entirely just on same-sex attraction or homosexuality or gay Christians in particular. It's relevant to that conversation, and that's what's brought it up recently. But I want to think more generally about how Christians experience sin and desire and understand those experiences and frame them kind of morally and theologically. So that's the kind of the way I'm going to kind of go in on this. Let me try and, I don't know, how about I start by kind of going, you tell me if you think this is true or not, Rory, but I feel like the default pastoral psychological approach to thinking about desire and temptation would say something along the lines of the experience of a desire isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's when that desire becomes lusting, becomes craving, becomes coveting, when you give in to the desire. And it becomes an evil desire, and you entertain the desire. Noticing an attraction is different from entertaining a desire or a lust. And so noticing or experiencing, for example, for a Christian who notices or experiences same-sex attraction or even exclusive same-sex attraction, that it's not necessarily a sin in and of itself to notice that orientation or that attraction. It's the giving into it and entertaining it and fantasizing and owning and lingering and so on and so forth. That's the issue. That someone, remember beaches? Remember crowded beaches? it's quite a quaint thought, but you know, if someone goes down to a crowded beach and a bunch of people scantily clad on the beach and they notice an experience of attraction, not necessarily a bad thing, but then when they give into that too, to leering and to looking and to lusting, that's the issue. Or to use a different kind of desire, if someone feels a flush of anger, the experience of anger or irritation or impatience is not necessarily in and of itself sinful, but it's then the being swept away by it, the inordinate desire, which is one way that concupiscence is translated sometimes into English, the inordinate desire where I swept off by it, that's the bad thing, you know. So you may just be hangry, so you eat some food and don't kick yourself too much. You may just be grumpy because you're tired, go and get a sleep. Don't necessarily, you know, so I think that's the kind of popular level evangelical pastoral theology, a distinction between an experience of a feeling or a desire or an orientation, or noticing that as opposed to giving into it in lust or coveting. But here's what gets interesting, because this issue goes back a long way into discussions with Pelagianism and Augustine's theology in the 5th century, and then in the Reformation discussions between Reformation theology and the Reformers, and the Catholic theology in the 16th century. It's got a long history. And it's often circles around this word translated from the Latin concupiscence, desires, actually the view I've just laid out in many ways seems to reflect more accurately the Roman Catholic theological view, where the Roman Catholic theological view wants to say that the experience of desires in and of themselves aren't sinful. It's when the will assents to those desires that then I sin. So my experience of these desires doesn't make me a sinner. It's only when I assent to the desires by the will that I become sinful. It sounds pretty similar, doesn't it? Yeah? That there's a sense in which, as well, we're going way back to the Roman Catholic view of what humans were when they were created. You could kind of say the Roman Catholic view of created pre-fall humanity is that in the natural existence, the Roman Catholic view of humanity is creaturely, that the human has, in the image of God, a will and freedom and these capacities to do good or to do evil, and which then therefore leaves the human being in and of itself liable to be moved by its creaturely desires and interests and so on. And then added to that is this state of grace granted by God that enables the human to actually be righteous and pursue God and conform to his will. And so then the fall is when a human loses that supernatural extra grace, and so then is left in its natural state, swayed by all these desires, as well as then carrying the guilt of the original parents and further weakened. and that then salvation is the removal of the sin of the original parents and this further weakness and the adding of the Spirit to enable human beings to once more please God as they serve him, further strengthened to be able to do that. But because that original sin of our original parents is taken away, now a Christian is by default kind of back to zero, back to neutral, and may still be blown here and there by desires, but those desires don't make them sinful. It's only when they assent to those desires in temptation that they commit sins that need forgiveness. So you see how, like, a little bit on the surface, when you hear that kind of Roman Catholic view, you go, oh, hang on, that's what I think, isn't it? That's what I've said, isn't it? That's what I've preached, isn't it? That's what I've read, isn't it? So am I Roman Catholic? By contrast to that, It's interesting to then notice how often in, say, the Westminster Confession of Faith or the 39 Articles, that when it comes to the topic of sin, the Reformation doctrine goes out of its way to say not just sinful acts, acts of the will, deliberate, decisive, conscious, willing deeds or entertainings of desire, but the actual experience of the lusts and the passions and the disorder and the temptations itself is sin. That while there's this distinction to some extent between sins and temptation of the corrupted nature, the corrupted nature itself is also corrupted. It's sinful. It's not just neutral. It's sin. That I'm a sinner because of my corrupted nature, and I experience my sinfulness in the desires and the temptations and the lusts of my corrupted nature, as well as in the giving into it. So the Reformation doctrine wants to say that actually that my corrupted nature itself is sin, not just the sins that come from it. And as a result, that sin is not just when I'm consciously, willingly, deliberately, from my will, assenting to a sin, but actually sin can actually have its origin and its trueness also in those things which are just in me, are inherited from the first parents, from Adam and Eve, that these, from birth, that I am corrupted, I am sinful, even though I didn't choose it, even though I was born this way, even though the desires are unwanted or unwilled, you know. So that kind of torment in Romans 7, what I want to do, I don't do, but what I hate, I do. And if I do what I don't want to do, I agree that the law is good. And it's wrestling even within my very self, and the sinful desires that wage war in my body, wage war against the law of my mind, that kind of thing. While elsewhere, of course, in the New Testament, we get told that even my mind is darkened and ignorant and blind. So my spirit, my mind, my body, all are corrupted, all are sinful, was the Reformation emphasis. So where do I kind of like, when things are said that way, I go, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense too. But then, does that mean that every experience of noticing a desire or attraction is a sinful desire, is a sin? Is that quite right? Some of the stuff that was really helpful in helping me kind of, I mean, I've read a bunch of stuff over the last few weeks as I was pondering this, as we talked about this episode, and that's all been really stimulating and interesting and enriching. But one of the really helpful launching off points was Kevin DeYoung gave a lecture on this whole kind of issue, sin, shame, and pain below the surface, how to make sense of same-sex attraction in the church. This is from the Gospel Reformation Network Vimeo channel. And he gets a good summary of all this kind of stuff. And then also an article by Denny Burke kind of explores these issues. Both of these are in reaction especially to the same-sex attraction kind of issue. The Denny Burke one is in the Evangelical Theological Seminary Journal or something like this. If you'd search Denny Burke and concupiscence, you'd find it. Is homosexual orientation sin from the Evangelical Theological Journal of Evangelical Theology, something like that. ETSJETS.org. Now both of these guys unpack a lot of this theological history that apply it to modern experiences of desire, temptation, and the discussion of homosexuality. And say, clearly then, homosexual orientation, homosexual attraction, is an attraction, an orientation, a desire that's in us, and even if it's in us from birth, doesn't matter, because that's part of our corrupted nature towards a corrupted end, therefore it's sin. And that when someone experiences that desire, that attraction, they are experiencing sin. They are being sinful in that moment and need to repent of that. That's their kind of line and their kind of argument. But something about this doesn't sit right with me. And so at this point, I'm really asking questions and trying to sharpen my own thinking to see if I've got it right. And I'm keen to hear your thoughts, Rory, as you ponder this as well. Is the Reformation formulations as unpacked by the reformers and those who came after them, and then as applied by Denny Burke or Kevin DeYoung to the modern discussions about homosexuality, is that full and thorough and so on? Is it true that any desire or attraction noticed on any level towards a bad object, so male-to-male erotic desire, that any noticing of anything like that is necessarily corrupt, disordered sin in equal measure? Or is it true, as Kevin DeYoung puts it, that that noticing the attractiveness of something in a neutral way, in an objective way, is very different to any personal attraction, that if I am attracted to something other than the person I'm married to, then that is sin? He gives the example of a father saying, I'm attracted to my daughter. He says, surely that's yuck. Surely there's something wrong there. Well, here are a couple of thoughts on what do you do. What do you do when you come across something from within your theological tradition that doesn't seem to necessarily capture everything fully or reflect what you intuitively think or fully make sense of experience? What do you do? Well, first of all, I reckon it's fair enough to go, I need to respect the tradition, even when I flinch at it, by saying, actually, this is seeing things that maybe I haven't seen yet, and seeing interconnections between theological issues that I haven't quite seen yet. And so I need to slow down and go, maybe my common sense view is more fallen human theology common sense, which, speaking from a conservative Protestant point of view, you'd go, well, isn't that what Roman Catholicism is all about, right? It makes sense from a human point of view. It's a humanistic version of religion at various points. And so I need to go, well, maybe this theology is seeing something I'm not seeing. I need to hear it out. I need to follow it through. I need to see why they've landed where they've landed. And yet, at the same time, it's okay to critique tradition, because those who formulated certain things in certain ways don't necessarily see everything fully clearly either, or haven't necessarily formulated everything in all its details fully either. Yeah, so I've got to respect the tradition and really take time to understand it, but also be willing to critique it carefully. And especially, I also need to be willing to critique the modern application of tradition to a new issue and a new framework. So I need to be careful as I read or listen to whoever it is, Denny Burke or Kevin DeYoung or whoever, as they reflect and apply these issues, because what we mean and what we're describing and what we talk about in the 21st century when we talk about desire, sin, attraction, orientation, the way we're using these words may not necessarily be exactly quite the same as the discussions about Pelagianism in the 4th and 5th century, or the discussions about concupiscence in the 16th, 17th century with the Reformation and total depravity. They may sound very similar, as I described that Roman Catholic view of sin at the start. Sounds very similar, but is it quite what I mean as an evangelical Protestant as I'm chatting about issues of desire and temptation today? And are the views that we quote from formulations of centuries gone by, are they balanced out in different ways, in different parts of the broader writing of different authors and theologians, not in the way and in the sequence that we would do it, and yet still they balance out their thoughts and their reflections and qualify them and concede things in different kinds of ways, So you've got to be on the lookout for all of that. And especially in these modern arguments, often the using of ancient theology in new settings often makes a jump in the logic that's actually the key point at issue. So you say, if this ancient theologian said this, and if they said that, that's A, B, and also C, if also in addition to that, then they add a C, which is, and if we also allow that X, Y, Z, and add a few extra points in, then clearly D. You see what I mean? So if A, about concupiscence, and if B, about sin and guilt, and then C, if also we bear in mind that how can attraction not be a form of evil desire? Or how can a desire for anything that's an evil object not be sinful, then D. And he says that that point, that third, and if also we allow, or given the case that, or every, you know, it's that extra point. Do you know what I mean? Where you're kind of saying, you're updating the theology for the current issue. That often that's the thing you've got to talk about. I mean, a similar thing kind of comes with political arguments where you say, if A is sinful, and B law, which facilitates that, is facilitating sin, and then point C is, you should always vote in accordance to this particular sinful issue whenever you vote for anybody, and it should be legislated for, you know. And so C is often actually the key point in that discussion around who you vote for, not whether A or B is in fact sinful, but the question is the strategic use of a vote and the proper place for outlawing this or that moral issue in a secular society, you know. And so it's this kind of, this, you've got to be on the lookout for that extra step in the argument. And so in this case, I think a case needs to be really argued for at length about what is the experience of desire and attraction, and is what is the psychological, biological, personal experience of desire and attraction, and are all aspects of desire and attraction equally, fully, totally explainable in terms of sin? And is that always the best and most adequate way to describe those experiences? That's worth asking. And is our experience as humans in the world, with all the different things in the world, are there necessarily kinds of objective noticing that almost always bring with them a degree of attraction, which isn't necessarily a sinful thing? So for a human being to notice another human being is objectively beautiful. Is that objective beauty, must it be separated from any sense of noticing attraction for it to be pure? Or is there a significant space between the observing of a beauty which is of a kind that humans are attracted to it, or in other cases, say, repelled from a danger that provokes a negative reaction? Are these things, these observings of pushings and pullings in the world, is there a significant place where those things are not best understood entirely in moral, evil desire, craving, lust, rage, greed categories? Yeah, there's extra work, I think, that's got to be done in all of that. We can't just rush to a simple application of these things, I don't reckon. Maybe. That's what I'm asking, and that's what I'm keen to hear what people think about it. So you listen to the tradition, don't dismiss it too quickly. You critique the tradition carefully. You critique particularly modern application of tradition to new situations. And then it's also helpful to ask, as you reflect on theological traditions and concepts and formulations, it's important to ask, what theological work is this particular theological idea doing? Why was it important? Why was it argued for? And in the case of concupiscence and the Reformation arguments and debates, as well as the Augustine debates with Pelagius, is that the point being made is we must not limit the reach of sin and preserve a significant place for human freedom and neutrality and potential untouched by sin. That human beings are desperately fallen in every part of our faculties, entirely unable to do spiritual good that merits or earns or cooperates or contributes to our salvation, or for Christians to participate in performing works that on any level, even by the grace of God, are considered to be meritorious in working towards our salvation. That a far-reaching grasp and emphasis that our very being and nature and identity and every aspect of us from birth inherits a corrupted nature which is in itself sinful, sin, guilty, says that there's no capacity in any part of my will or my desires that can prepare a way or participate in being saved initially, converted, Or can prepare the way or participate meritoriously in earning salvation. But then in all of this, I'm a sinner, I'm sinful. It is only by the grace of God, sustained by the grace of God, forgiven by the grace of God, preserved by the grace of God, justified by the grace of God, that I can be saved. That's the theological work it's doing. And so that's the sense in which total depravity says sin touches every part of me, every aspect of me is corrupted, therefore is sinful, therefore is sin, therefore I am in need of grace alone for conversion, grace alone for final salvation. All of which means that actually even if there are good desires, noble desires, ordered desires, like the desire to worship God, the desire to love my wife and my kids, the desire to enjoy food to sustain my body, even those desires are tainted and corrupted and sinful because I'm totally depraved. So even if there is a space for attraction and desire that is not of a fundamentally moral type, but is just a part of the experience of the human creature in God's world, that because I'm fallen and corrupted, it is tainted still. Even if it in and of itself is not sin, it is tainted by sin nevertheless. So even if my ponderings before are true, that doesn't deny the fact that actually sin taints at all, even the things that are in themselves good. That's the theological work this does. And then last of all, it is good to ask, what pastoral work does this theological point do? What pastoral work does it do? And there's a lot of pastoral importance to fully grasping original sin and the extent of original sin as total depravity. All of my faculties are darkened and weakened and poisoned and corrupted and disordered and sinful, therefore. This deeply drives me to repentance again and again. Deeply drives me to beg God to forgive me and to lead me by the power of His Spirit, doesn't it? It ought to make me really suspicious of my motives, of my desires, of my thoughts, of my intuitions, of my common sense, all of that, shouldn't it? That someone who shrinks too much down and keeps asking, well, which bit's the sinful bit? Which bit's the sinful bit? Surely that's innocent. Surely that's justifiable. Surely that's merely psychological or merely natural. The more you shrink the reach of sin, the more risk there is that we will be deceived by our desires and our intuitions and our lusts and our quote-unquote felt needs, you know? And so it's really right for us to be alert, to be on our guard about how sin poisons and distorts and deceives and corrupts everything, even our mind, and also our desires. So that's a really powerful pastoral need to recognize that. And so as a result, therefore, also even as pastors and Christian leaders, we need to beware of being overly confident in our pastoring and our preaching that we see everything right. Hey, we're still simultaneously righteous and sinners. Sin still dwells in us, corrupts and disorders. So we need to be careful that our pastoral judgments and strategic decisions as church leaders are always right and not poisoned by sin too. So that's the powerful pastoral work, original sin, total depravity, the view of concupiscence, the evil desire in and of itself, that sinful does. So a few final thoughts. Final thought number one. While wanting to say that humans were not merely neutral animals without the supernatural state of grace, while I want to say that humans were righteous, naturally inclined to do good and serve and worship God, that that's part of the image of God. I nevertheless want to say that the first human beings still were creatures. So the risk of a Reformation view of the original sinlessness and righteousness of humanity, the risk is that we end up creating a non-creaturely, non-animal, non-physical view of humanity. No experience of just the natural inclinations toward food or fear or sexuality at all. You end up with like the bizarre stuff that Augustine gets stuck into, arguing that in Eden before the fall, Adam would have had willed control over the erection for the purpose of sex. so as not to be led astray by unwilled lust, you know, and so that even married Christians are still engaging in a tolerable way with concupiscence and lust in their married sex. There's something off about that, you see. There's something missing about a sense that there is attraction that's just part of our locatedness in a world of attractions and repulsions. So while I want to say that nevertheless these attractions and repulsions were ordered to the good, to original righteousness without a need for some extra state of grace, they still were present in unfallen humanity. And so still, while they can be tainted by sin in the experience of a Christian, that the noticing of these things are not in themselves wrong. You get little glimmers of this in various writers recognising that there are the spontaneous noticing of these things and that's just part of our creaturely existence. And maybe one other thought is... a couple other thoughts. I mean, one is just related to that, really. And I'll just say it briefly, but if all noticing of attraction outside of the object of marriage is in and of itself sin, then it kind of leads you to wonder how a godly Christian chooses to get married to begin with. Because because surely part of the reason you get married to someone is you notice and attracted to something in the way they look, amongst other things. And yet you're not yet married to them, and so that attraction is not yet morally justifiable in its fulfilment. So, I mean, that's just an example, I think, of where there is a legitimate place for this kind of stuff. And then a final thought, coming back to, I guess, the pastoral usefulness of thinking about original sin and total depravity, is it is a warning against going too far down the line of modern psychology set free from theological frameworks. That modern psychology can drift into areas that are useful, but without the Christian framework, actually misleading. A really helpful book, The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris, is really, really helpful in lots of ways. It's one of those acceptance commitment therapy books that enhances the cognitive behavioural psychology stuff in some new ways. Very helpful. A bunch of people probably read it and been helped by, including Christians. It's got lots in it that's very useful, but at a couple of points it betrays a very different view of personhood and morality that's not really Christian at all. And at this point, it must not be adopted uncritically. Here's a quote from The Happiness Trap, 53% in my Kindle edition. It says, the observing self within us can't be judged as good or bad, right or wrong, because all it does is observe. If you do the wrong thing or the bad thing, the observing self is not in any way responsible. It merely notices what you've done and helps make you aware of it, therefore able to learn from it. Moreover, the observing self will never judge you, because judgments are thoughts and the observing self can't think. The observing self sees things as they are without judging, criticising, or doing any other thinking processes that set us up for a struggle with reality. Therefore, it gives acceptance in its truest, purest form. It's almost more Buddhist, isn't it? That there's a non-self that doesn't think, that doesn't act, that doesn't do, that merely observes and accepts in its truest, purest form. But that acceptance is almost empty in and of itself. Now, that's a bizarre view of identity in the end. You don't need to adopt that view of human identity and morality to be helped by the useful insights of ACT kind of psychology stuff necessarily, or by the Happiness Trappers book. But at that point, man, no, I am not just my observing self, but my doing, thinking, desiring, acting, judging self. And I do bad things, and I do wrong things, and sometimes I overly dwell on those things and misunderstand those things and misapply those things, but I still do them. And sometimes I'm right to feel bad about it, and that drives me towards repentance, and that drives me towards godliness, and so on and so forth. So, I don't think I've really answered much, have I? I've asked a lot of questions. And in a sense, what I guess I'm trying to do in this, as we help pastor Christians towards godliness, is I want to say, yes, we've got to have a pervasive view of sin and sinfulness in every aspect of human experience, and that this inherited corrupted nature is itself sinful. Yes. And yet, in the way we understand the dynamics of human experience and activity, I want to pull apart the experience of noticing, attraction, orientation, desire, and make more of that experience than simply godly affection, sinful desire, and the will. I want to say there's got to be some place, I think, in our deep view of the pervasiveness of sin, to still say that our experience of attraction, orientation, desire, and observation is not entirely bound up merely with sinful desire, godly affection, and the will, but also, in a sense, the creaturely experience of one kind and another, which is a separate category in the mix as well, still tainted by sin, but a separate category in the mix. I think that's what I'm trying to say. I'm really keen to hear anyone's thoughts, including, hopefully, Rory, you can get around to recording a pen pal episode response sometime in the coming weeks. Look forward to hearing from you.